The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more. We have an excellent and thought-provoking show for you this week. I'm going to talk to film critic Stephen Garrett about two movies. There is Saturday Night, which is Jason Reitman's ode to the first episode of Saturday Night Live. And we're going to talk about Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis, which was a huge $100 million boondoggle passion project from the 85-year-old director that is hilariously bad and also kind of hilariously good and definitely worth talking about. Film people talk about it, and Stephen and I are film people, and so we're going to give it a go a little bit later in the episode. I'm also going to talk to TV critic Matthew Ehrlich about English Teacher, which is a fun, terrific high school comedy starring Brian Jordan Alvarez, and that's airing on FX and Hulu. I really enjoy this show, and I think you will too. But first, taped from my office in Austin, Texas, it's me and Stephen Garrett talking about Saturday Night.
Saturday Night, it's a new kind of entertainment.
You haven't locked the script.
What script?
Your actors are missing. Your kids aren't ready for prime time.
Everyone down to the eighth floor now!
We just have to make it to air.
From New York, it's Saturday Night!
Lauren, you ordered a llama?
You are so fluffy.
Hey, come on, Andy.
It is political season here in the United States of America, and every Sunday morning, our social media feeds are full of celebrity impersonations of political candidates, courtesy of Saturday Night Live, which has gone beyond being an institution, and now is just like it's like a piece of furniture that we all sit on.
True.
And it's the ultimate show for normies. As far as I'm concerned, it doesn't mean it's necessarily bad, although it is sometimes bad, but it's certainly not the revolutionary avant-garde television experience that is depicted in Jason Reitman's Saturday Night, which has recently come and gone at the box office, died like a dog, died like a dog that Michael O'Donoghue anally raped and shot and left in an alley, as he would say. Boy, what an edgy guy that Michael O'Donoghue was, huh, Stephen?
He was pretty edgy, man. Don't cross him.
He was edgy. He made fun of priests.
It was a different time.
He really took on the man in a really dangerous kind of way.
Yeah, not like Milton Berle. Not like Uncle Milty.
No, Uncle Milty was a sellout perv who liked to fling his very large member around, apparently. All right, so here's the movie, Jason Reitman's Saturday Night. This is not a successful film. It has not resonated with people, and I have some opinions as to why. Now, you really like this thing.
I liked it. I'm a normie and I grew up with Saturday Night Live, so I'm very partial to it, and I have warm and fuzzy memories of how it began and its subversive nature.
Yeah.
But for this pre-adolescent, it seems super edgy and dangerous. And I guess it was maybe at a
maybe,
time for
maybe.
Some. I don't know. Still TV. Still had censors.
Look, this was this is a movie for people who, you know, have read like the oral history of improv comedy in America, or, you know, a book about the Second City. You know, there's a lot of just sort of sly references to alt comedy history.
Yeah. Well, I think that might be a reason why people are turned off by it, just because there's so many in jokes and there's so many references to a lot of deep cuts. If you're familiar, as you're saying, with that sort of scene and the people in it.
Yeah.
A lot of people come and go in this movie very quickly. So I think that is, and I got some of it and get all of it. And I kind of dug that, but this is a movie made by fans for fans for sure.
Yes. I feel like it's a bit of a smug celebration, like a victory lap, by, people who have long since stopped being alternative or edgy. And so to me, I think that's its central problem. Also the fact that it's like the only times it's actually funny to me are when they're actually recreating the original skits.
Which were pretty funny skits.
Yeah, well, exactly. Like, and when you see that, or when Garrett Morris sings a song, or just the actual skits themselves are good, but like the wacky Lorne Michaels running around 30 Rock trying to deal with all the dysfunctional characters, and it just felt very self-indulgent. And you know, here's the thing, this is a movie that contains characters like George Carlin and Jim Henson, right? And yet it lauds as the great creative genius of the time Lorne Michaels. And it mocks Jim Henson relentlessly, and it mocks George Carlin relentlessly. George Carlin played very effectively, I might add, by Matthew Rhys.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they were making fun of Carlin more than they were pointing out that Carlin had no idea what the hell this was and didn't want to look foolish, didn't want to slip on a banana peel in front of millions of people.
Yeah.
I was reading a little something about him at that time, and he was somebody who was over 30 at a time where this show purported not to trust anybody over 30.
Right.
You know, that kind of counterculture thing. And he was counterculture, but he was, you know, a kind of generation, not a generation removed, but
half a generation.
He was half a generation off. So I guess that could explain it. Jim Henson, I do think, was like a bona fide, like solid gold dork, you know. And I'm sorry, Muppet Show's cute, but is kind of exhausting, and Sesame Street is fantastic for what it is. But, you know, it always was a head scratcher to me why they reached out, the show reached out and had Jim Henson in some of those earlier episodes at late night. He's just not a late night kind of guy, you know, he was a square, and that's not bad. It just is Jim Henson. He shouldn't be there.
Right. Well, he is there. And the show gives him the movie gives him an awfully hard time.
Yeah,
I mean, look, it's fun. It's kind of fun. I thought that the cast, I didn't actually really like the guy who played Lorne Michaels. I felt like he was actually just somewhat flat, and the movie lionized him to the extent that it was obnoxious. Honestly, it was kind of like, Lorne, you're a genius. You're a great forgotten boy of the world. I just couldn't get behind it.
I mean, I think Lorne Michaels is flat, and I think most people would say that about him and say it with affection. I mean, he's a bit of a cipher, right, for that whole experience of – I saw it very much, and I think the reason I liked it as much as I did was, you know, this is a very much a, hey, kids, let's put on a show type environment where, you know, like the knives are drawn from every angle, and you just get a sense that everybody wants him to fail. And yet he wants to kind of go on with the show and hope to God that it pulls together. And I think there is a little sense of that panic in every week of the show. I mean, it's a live wire of an act just to put a live show on every week. And it has been for 50 years.
But we've all seen 30 Rock, many episodes of 30 Rock. And
right.
Almost any given episode of 30 Rock, except for maybe its last season, is funnier and gets that sense of creative panic across better than this.
Well, it does. And I don't disagree, but that's also, those are people at an established brand that knows the humor of that show. And I'm talking backstage, these people putting on the show, and that panic is one that is largely kind of, it's well-heeled. They are familiar with the panic. This is the raw panic of doing something for the very first time and not knowing what it is and not knowing how to write for any of the people in the cast, and the cast members themselves not really knowing what their shtick is yet. and kind of getting to know each other as much as they're getting to know themselves and also getting to know a national audience. So I just found it kind of this wonderful look at an embryonic kind of what ended up being a bit of a supernova and what is now kind of a dying star, but it's still in the firmament, you know, solidly. And like you're saying, it's a piece of furniture that we're all used to. I liked it.
I know. I found the single camera movement, I found it twitchy and annoying. Yeah. I found it a little pretentious. Although I will say, like, I liked a lot of the people who were sort of impersonating the original cast members were fun to watch. Like the guy who did that guy did a wicked Dan Aykroyd. I thought the John. I felt like I was watching old young John Belushi.
Yeah, amen.
Young Chevy Chase too. You know, the guy who played Chevy Chase was excellent.
And they do a great job. I don't want to say they're impersonating. I mean, they're kind of
channeling. You know, they're channeling.
They're channeling and not mimicking. You know, it's a real impressive. Nuanced. It's hard to be nuanced when you're doing caricature, and they weren't doing caricatures. I feel like they were doing, it's almost like when you see a star before they become a star. If you see like the movie before they made it big and they don't quite look like themselves, they look like some weird unformed version of themselves.
Yeah.
You know, like Julia Roberts in Mystic Pizza, where she's just like, she kind of looks like herself, but she's also, she's not the big mega wattage star from Pretty Woman or anything after that.
Right.
You know?
Kind of fun.
There's a raw sensibility that I really admired that he captured.
I guess, although I can see why it's not resonating with audiences because it's too artsy fartsy and twitchy for its own good.
It's kind of an in-joke.
It's an in-joke. Let's say this though. Milton Berle, played by J.K. Simmons. That's that's the scene stealer. That's the guy. That scene where they go to the other studio and he's dancing with the showgirls. Just...
Ugh.
Yeah. It was disgusting, but also really phenomenal and fun. And I just wish that was to me actually when they just calmed down and just showed that scene where he was dancing with the showgirls. That to me was the only moment where the show really, the movie really captured a kind of a FU countercultural sensibility because it went outside of itself and was really like honing in and making fun of something. And you could see for that one moment exactly what Saturday Night Live was culturally reacting to.
Right, right. Yeah, that is very fair. That is very fair. I mean, I also like when it threw to Janice Ian in that really kind of startling moment where there's just chaos and then it just like cuts to her performing or rehearsing, I guess. Yeah.
And all the Teamsters are watching her with like
all the Teamsters watching her sing about being 17.
That was good. And also a John Batiste Billy Preston impersonation was quite fun.
I thought that was fun. I mean, there's a manic chaos about the whole thing.
Some critics are really hating on this movie. I'm somewhere between the haters and you, Stephen. Like
that's fair. That's fair. It's not for everybody. It's just like the show. It's not, you know, hey, funny is very subjective. I think what I responded to was seeing something that we're so familiar with that we can't imagine not being around. And you see it at its inception and everything is so improbable that it all comes together the way it does. I mean, you look at any kind of major, I don't know, you watch any documentary about like Star Wars before it came out or like Back to the Future before it comes out. And all these things are just like, right on the edge of falling apart because nobody believes in them and they just don't seem to make sense.
Right.
And then something clicks and you're just like, wow, you know, I'm a sucker for that.
Sure. Well, let's just say this, you know, Jason Reitman is not going to be getting an angry phone call from Lorne Michaels who will be able to put this trophy on his wall. All right. Saturday Night is coming to video on demand very soon because no one, unlike the actual Saturday Night Live, no one gave a shit about it. No one went to see it in theaters. I'm going to take it out back and put it in Nun's Habit. Skin it alive, burn it alive, staple it to a wall and cover it in fake blood.
All right. That's what you want to do. I don't know. I mean, that's, you know.
I think the people will love it, Stephen. All right. We'll be back to talk to you about a very, very crazy movie, Megalopolis, after this television segment.
An F?
You can't do this.
I didn't do this. You did this.
With grades like this, I'm going to have to hit the corner, sir.
Who's running the school? Is it us or is it them?
Them. Them.
Becca said I have no butt.
Just saying it could be bigger.
I can't comment on this.
I can. You're good. Oh, it is flat.
A non-binary person does not identify as male or female.
Like a hermaphrodite.
No.
Yes.
That word is not in use anymore, is it?
I don't know.
One of my favorite TV shows of the year and definitely my favorite comedy of the year is something called English Teacher, which just finished its first season on FX, and it is airing in perpetuity on Hulu. But not a lot of people I know are watching it. It's hard to find anyone to talk about English Teacher with. I've been watching it with my wife, but she doesn't want to talk to me any more than she has to. So I thought, who among my contributors is watching English Teacher? And it occurred to me that Matthew Ehrlich has probably tuned into this, and he's here today to talk to me about it. Hello.
Hey.
Hey, yeah. So, Matthew, you were just telling me that you are enjoying English Teacher, but you're having trouble finding people to talk about it with.
Yeah, actually, I created a WhatsApp chat group of my gay friends where the purpose of it was to urge everyone to watch it, because I think it's a really great gay show as opposed to a queer show. And I don't think it's being marketed very well. It does seem, as you said in your review, it looked from the advertising as though it's kind of like, you know, an also ran of Abbott Elementary, or Abbott Elementary was a hit, so let's bring on The English Teacher.
Yeah.
And I almost thought it was a spinoff of The English Teacher with
like of Abbott Elementary, you mean?
Yeah. And it's so different. I mean, and Abbott Elementary is a formidable, great show. I mean no disrespect to that show and what it does, but this show is so different and so wonderful and very funny and very and really groundbreaking on many levels, I think. But also a very enjoyable, you know, lovely show. Yeah.
It is a very gay show. As you pointed out, the main character, Evan Marquez, is played by Brian Jordan Alvarez, who I'm assuming is gay. I mean, I can't imagine that the references and the point of view in the show could come from anything but a gay man. He's a Colombian American, so he's, you know, Latino, but I wouldn't say that plays a huge part in the show. More, it's more of his gay identity that is the sort of key to everything, because he plays a high school English teacher in suburban Austin. Although, you know, I live in Austin and almost live in suburban Austin, and let's be clear, the show is actually filmed in Los Angeles.
Right.
You know, there is this Texas vibe to the show, right? There's lots of guns around. There's sort of our nosy PTA moms, you know, but it's also very Austin in that, you know, the kids are diverse and neurodiverse student body. There are lots of queer kids. You know, one of my favorite, the funniest episodes, there's a Powder Puff football game, and Evan brings in a drag queen to teach the football players how to vogue, basically.
And then he steals all the printers.
Yeah, he's a kleptomaniac who basically lives in his car at the same time. So this is not a woke show.
Well, it's interesting because it's not a woke show, and it's not an anti-woke show either. It's almost kind of like a show that uses the battle between red state, blue state, or whatever, as sort of a background upon which everything kind of comes into focus. And it's almost like, you know, your mom turning around on a car trip and saying, kids, stop fighting. I don't care who started it. It's like, we've been dealing with this since 2016 as a nation, and now it's become background noise. And that's how I see it.
Yeah. And I think the show makes good use of that. Right. And it just kind of takes it as a fact of life, as opposed to it doesn't take a side. And let's be clear too, this is not a didactic show. I mean, it is a light character based comedy. You know, and the side character, I mean, you know, Brian Jordan Alvarez is funny, but he's also kind of the straight man, so to speak. Obviously, because he's not very straight. You know, to me, the funniest characters are Marky, who is the gym teacher, played by Sean Patton.
Right. He's kind of, I guess, like he has roots in, you know, Ron Swanson from Parks and Recreation.
Kind of.
But not quite. I mean, it's like, at first, that's how I've had him pegged, but he's a little different than that.
Yeah, he's not quite as dogmatically libertarian. He's not smart, but he's kind of street smart, but he's also not that street smart. He's very funny. And I also love Gwen, played by Brian Jordan Alvarez's kind of comedic co-conspirator.
Right. Whose husband is digging a pool in their backyard with his
hand. By hand, because he's out of work. Her boyfriend.
Oh, right. Yeah,
boyfriend, not her husband, which is key because there's a kind of a will. She's played by Stephanie Koenig, and there's kind of this will they.
Who's adorable.
Who is adorable, agreed, you know, appealing to people of all stripes. You know, there's kind of a will they, won't they tension building a little bit with the gym teacher, sort of. But it's not as cliched as the will they, won't they in Abbott Elementary, which has kind of become the focus of that show.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting to compare it to Abbott Elementary because, like you said, like that is an Emmy-winning canonical sitcom, right? Like, we'll always be talking about it. And it's also kind of like the last of the great mockumentary sitcoms. Like, they're not going to do it. I hope they don't do it anymore after this. But it also that show feels very safe to me, safe politically.
Right. And it's sort of, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's all about the kids and did we reach them? And there's nothing, you know, how like Seinfeld was like, no one learns any lessons or whatever. There's like a refreshing, like, this is teaching is a job and it, you know, shit goes in, shit goes out. And they are good teachers. I think they are very engaged in what they're doing, but it's not held up in this kind of, you know, glorified way. It's just kind of, it's a job, you know, and it's a workplace comedy.
Yeah. An English teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Abbott Elementary, it's a little bit more lionized. I think Quinta Brunson's mother is a teacher, so it's got a little bit more of, you know, proselytizing for the profession.
Right. Exactly. And I love the character Linda Harrison, who's played by Jen Lyon. And she's kind of set up as like, you know, she's the one who tries to get the English teacher fired for essentially making out with his boyfriend in front of her gay son, essentially. And there's sort of a sense that in other sitcoms, she's the Karen or she's the one who needs to learn the lesson of, you know, homophobia is wrong and you need to accept your gay son. And she's not really, I don't see her redeeming herself in the near future. She's not really set up as like a villain. She's kind of a formidable opponent and she has an agenda and she's like very charming. Like, I love it whenever she's on screen. She's hilarious without being campy or iconic or like, you know, Joan Crawford. But like, there's something like the restaurant that she runs looks like it would be a really good restaurant. I would like to eat there.
That restaurant is so Texas. You know, it's got
the steak fingers. Yeah, exactly.
No, steak nuggets.
Steak nuggets. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And the thing that the show does, it kind of, I believe Alvarez and Koenig have a background in improv because it does this thing where it calls back stuff from previous episodes. Like, for instance, there's my least favorite episode of the season is one where they have the camping trip, like, which just felt like a very typical sitcom trope. But there's this parent who chaperones the trip. This black woman who is obsessed right. with the fact that the kids are playing quote unquote.
She is like completely susceptible to every single moral panic that ever comes across her way.
Yes, right. She's terrified the kids are playing sex games when in fact the kids are not playing sex games. But then what I love is that there's a parent teacher meeting in the subsequent episode and she steps in for one line and grabs the microphone and starts talking about how she's worried that the kids.
Reverse glory hole.
Yeah. Just out of nowhere. And then she goes away. That's her one line.
And I really would love to have her in every single episode coming in with a new moral panic. I think that they have to do that. I wish they would do that.
Yeah, it's great. It's kind of that's the thing that really good comedies do. It pays off if you've watched previous episodes when something like that happens. And there was also a scene, they go to a teacher's conference in Dallas, which my wife, who is a teacher, says really accurately reflected the sort of the downer vibe. You know, there was something glamorous about it, but there was a moment where they're kind of hanging out in the hotel pool and Gwen is just kind of treading water and talking to the gym teacher and she says out of nowhere, "Do you think it's weird that my boyfriend is digging a pool in the backyard by hand?" You know, and then that was it. It just out of nowhere. And it's like, oh, and then she called that back and it continues to be a theme. So it's just really funny, really charming and really light. Like, and the episodes are short. You know, you're not dragged into this world for hours and hours on end.
Right. And I like the way that it treats the gayness of the main character, whose name I keep forgetting because it's this goddamn
Evan yeah. Marquez.
I like the way that he is not, you know, most gay protagonists, they're safely in monogamous relationships or they're very slutty, but in need of redemption, you know, like, oh, like, I'm just sleeping around because I'm scared of intimacy and one day the right man's going to come along and save me from all this, you know, or they don't have sex at all and they have like cats and dogs and, you know, nephews or whatever.
Right.
What I love about Evan is that he has a sex life. It's messy, but they're not treating it as though there's something wrong with the fact that he has a messy sex life. He's an attractive adult gay man. Who is kind of doing what anyone would do, what any heterosexual woman would do on a show like Sex and the City or something like that. There's something very fun about it.
Well, he has an ex-boyfriend.
Right, yeah, who's kind of a dick, but they can't stop sleeping together. And that's not even really treated as like something terribly pernicious. It's just sort of like, oh Lord, you know,
it's treated as something that would happen.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think the show is pretending that this relationship is healthy or that these guys right. are, that mm-hmm. these guys are good for each other, but it's not sex negative in that sense.
Yeah. And then even the, I guess what I had pegged initially as the love interest, and I forget his name.
There's that black guy who came in the early episode. Right. He vanishes. He just goes away.
Well, he basically, you know, it seemed as though they were sort of getting together. And then it turns out that he's in a relationship, but it's an open relationship. And he would like to just have sex with Evan on the side.
But Evan's too neurotic to really make that work.
Right. And he probably shouldn't be dating a teacher and so forth. It was just, you know, I just think it's all sort of handled very well.
Really, the show handles everything very well. It's very smart. Yeah. It's very smart. It's very low key. And I really wish more people were watching it. I'm concerned that it's not going to get a second season, although FX does seem to be patient with some of its comedic projects. And
it's getting very good reviews. It's been spoken about on podcasts, and I just don't think it's being marketed very well. The ads that I see on the subways here in New York City, you just make it seem like it's a feel-good comedy. Like, I don't know. I was not thinking of watching it until someone urged me to do that.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure exactly what is the comparison show. You know, because it's not like one of those ABC talking. It's not a mockumentary.
It's almost like someone was like going, okay, look, Abbott Elementary is a success. We need another teacher comedy. And then Brian Jordan Alvarez had some very, you know, was making a huge splash on TikTok with a lot of his impersonations. And so maybe someone said, let's work with him. Let's develop something. And then it became its own thing.
It's its own thing, right? What I like about it is that this is a different, it's coming from different voices. You know, you feel like a lot of times every comedy on TV is channeled through either Chuck Lorre or Stephen Levitin or on the good end, the Tina Fey machine or Taika Waititi, et cetera, et cetera. There's like a new branch of the comedy tree. And if anything, I think, you know, it feels a little bit more like the sort of its sensibility is almost more like Arrested Development than Abbott Elementary. But it's also gay and it's also about schools. I don't know. Look, English Teacher's really good. It's really funny.
Yes.
And you're not going to be sorry you watched it. Matthew Ehrlich and I both recommend it. Highly. Matt, I'm going to go back to, I'm digging a swimming pool in my backyard by hand, Matthew. So
I can't believe you didn't invite me to come along.
Look, you weren't going to help.
But you guys ordered pizza.
Yeah, all right. Next time. I know you won't come, but I'll invite you. All right, Matthew Ehrlich, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
With your eyes closed, walk into the future.
I don't get it.
You will.
Here's my plan to create a utopia.
Megalopolis.
People don't need drinks.
People need help now.
Bingo.
We're in need of a great debate about the future.
We are here and we are taking our country back.
I feel like we need to talk about Megalopolis on this program, even though this is the opposite of a hit movie. I feel like there's something significant about Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis. I can't quite put my finger on what it is, though, Stephen. What do you think? Why does this movie, even though it's you know, objectively, interestingly bad, and, you know, even terrible in a lot of ways, but there's something about it that like that resonated with me in a kind of a fun, campy way.
Yeah, I mean, it's not boring. I didn't think it was boring.
No,
I've watched it now twice. I saw it a second time a few months after I first saw it in May, and then went to a Monday 10:30 screening. 10:30 at night on a Monday, and it was kind of half full, and I was surprised, and the audience was with it. They were laughing occasionally at it, but also mostly laughing with it because it is very intentionally funny, and has a good sense of humor about itself, I think.
Sometimes.
And then at the end, well, I tell you, at the end, there was some fairly solid applause and then one really loud boo.
Yeah. Well, to me, like, you know, we talked about Joker Folie à Deux last week, which there's already a bit of critical revisionism where there's some people out there who are saying this is a brilliant film. I think it's a disaster. Whereas Megalopolis, is bad in a kind of a showgirls kind of way, you know, in a so bad it's good kind of way. Like, it, and you're right. There is actually, you know, Francis Ford Coppola does not have his finger on the pulse of what's up.
Right. Used to. He used to have a very good grip on, not just a finger, but a grip on the pulse.
Yeah, he was the zeitgeist, but he's not anymore. And that's okay. Yeah. You know, you wouldn't expect someone who's 85 to, you know, there's a lot of just kind of pretentious blathering on about the importance of being smart. and it's kind of like the fountainhead for liberals in some ways. Yeah. You know, but there's also, you know, there is some good satire. Like, my favorite comedy bit was there's this Vestal Virgin pop star who's not a virgin. And when that's revealed, they immediately show a music video where she's like some kind of like slutty Madonna like figure, like surrounded by flames. Yes. Which I thought was actually really kind of fun and kind of witty. But let's talk about the actual meat of the movie, right? Adam Driver plays Caesar. Is his name Caesar?
Oh, boy.
Caesar Cardini, the inventor of the Caesar salad. I don't know. He plays a genius inventor who has created some substance that, like, can, like, shape the future to its will. And there's, like, a whole conspiracy, political conspiracy in, quote-unquote, New Rome, which is New York City. You know, they're trying to sort of get a piece of him and also prevent him from moving the future forward. There's just a lot of shenanigans, a lot of sort of bad political metaphor.
Yeah, yeah. His name is Caesar Catalina, and I think this is
Catalina.
Supposed to be the Catalan conspiracy, which I've heard people mention, but I've never actually studied Roman history to the extent that I would know.
Right. And like John Voight plays a banker named Crassus, and then there's Mayor Cicero, played by Giancarlo Esposito. And, you know, your mileage may vary. I felt like Giancarlo Esposito, he's having a, you know, huge decade on TV. I don't feel like his Mayor Cicero will go alongside Gus Fring as his greatest performance.
No, it won't. I mean, it really won't for anybody. I mean, actually, if anything, I think Adam Driver kind of acquits himself pretty well of a pretty thankless task, which is to make this all watchable and to make his character interesting, which it's kind of not. But I think, you know, I think Coppola has said this time and again. Also, like, let's not forget he made One from the Heart, which is stylistically really like fascinating and beautiful to watch, but a bit of a dud, and he stumbled with his big swings before. I mean, this is the curse of being a master and then living too long and still wanting to make movies. You get restless. You want to try new things. And when you try new things, you fail more often than not.
Well, this movie definitely fails, but it is a very, unlike, let's say, Joker, which we talked about last week, it's an interesting failure and a kind of fun to watch failure. And I wanted to point out two performances in particular that I felt like really popped, right? One is Shia LaBeouf as the villain.
Amen.
Hilariously bad.
Well, I mean, he really goes for it. He's asked to do some pretty ridiculous things, and he just absolutely goes, you know, goes for broke, you know. So is he being bad, or is it just a conceptually bad idea, this character? I don't know.
The whole thing is the conceptually bad idea combined with his hammy acting and the wooden writing and the just insane set design and the whole thing. But no one, in my mind, tops Aubrey Plaza as Wow Platinum, who's like a Wall Street money bunny on like a financial network who then marries the richest banker in New York. And she has no shame, that actor.
I feel like she's the only one of the few people who knows how to act for this material and knows what her character is in this movie.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of other people, especially the older actors like John Voight, seem pretty befuddled and confused, or maybe that's just them. Certainly Dustin Hoffman is just a big question mark, his whole performance and his whole character and his whole being there. And he dies in a big collapse of a building, which I thought was even funnier.
Almost off screen.
Yeah. It's like they cut to him dying, cut back, you know, like what? It's a head scratcher. But they're also, I found myself kind of moved by certain moments in the film and also really kind of stirred by how often characters talked about how important it is to think about the future, to not just discuss, but argue about ideas of what society should be and what our role in it should be. And I don't know, it's wrestling with big questions. It doesn't really do a good job presenting them in an absorbing, dramatic way. It's more like a Cliff Notes version of itself, right? It's telling you all the things it wants to be without actually being any of those things.
Right. It is like a weird, it's like the stuff people argue about on Twitter or X, but directed by Fritz Lang.
Well, that's the thing too. I think Coppola is doing some things. I think he's directing and doing some visual embellishments that you have not seen since the 1920s or 1930s.
Yeah.
Which is to say there's some visual vocabulary going on, cinematic vocabulary that has completely fallen out of style or maybe forgotten. So they feel weirdly fresh and new and interesting. He's experimenting, you know?
It was like German Expressionism. It was cool to watch, I will say. And even the story itself had like a classical Shakespearean structure. Right. Yeah. Like, you know, it had a tragicomic arc, but it just, the script needed editing. It needed tightening. There was somewhere in there one of the greatest movies ever made. This was not, it's not what we got by any stretch of the imagination, but it's in there. That's why I think that this movie is worth talking about. Yeah. It's in there.
Well, you know, and it's funny, I rewatched Hearts of Darkness, you know, that documentary George Lucas and Lindbergh made about Apocalypse Now. And
making of Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, and there are all these audio recordings that his wife, Eleanor, made, conversations she had with him, and really captures his second guessing himself and doubting himself and really being in almost panic mode of just like, this is a disaster. What am I doing? And she was like, what are you worried? You're going to get a C? And she's like, no, I'm going to get an F. This movie absolutely fails. Like even he was convinced, but I think at the time he still had so much savvy mojo and maybe discipline as a storyteller, as a filmmaker, that he kind of salvaged it and made it into what I think is like one of the best movies of the 70s.
Really ever made, in my opinion. I've seen it many times.
Okay. Yeah, I think that guy is not around anymore. Clearly he isn't. No. I mean, he's 85 and he's surrounded by people who absolutely adore him and adore his legacy. I think back then he was still unsure of what his legacy might be. And I think he just had a little bit more of a grip on how to make a movie for the ages. Whereas here, I feel like he's just doing it because he can and he still wants to. There's a sincerity to it.
It's earnest. And it's bad. I will say, and we got to wrap this up, Natalie Emmanuel is in this movie a lot. She's the love interest of Caesar Catalina or whatever. Whatever accent she's doing, she tries to do this like Brooklyn Bronx accent. It kind of comes and goes. She does, however, look freaking amazing in every scene. I could not take my eyes off of her.
Yeah, she's got a bright future, hopefully.
Well, maybe. I don't know. Yeah. All right. Well, Megalopolis, I don't know where you're going to be able to see Megalopolis, but don't see it sober if you have to, if you don't have to. And, just go at it by look at it sincerely and also ironically. And I think you'll be happy.
I do feel like the world is a better place for having this crazy movie in it, you know?
It's the magic of cinema. All right, Steven, we'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
All right, thank you, Steven Garrett. Megalopolis got pushed off of IMAX screens too early by Joker Faliadu, but you can catch it somewhere on some screen of some size at some point. It's worth looking at if you are interested in movies. It is a case study in both what to do and what not to do. Saturday Night will also, I'm sure, be available on a Lorne Michaels approved streaming service very soon. Your mileage may vary on that. I didn't love it. Steven thought it was a lot more fun than I did. And you really need to watch English Teacher, which is on FX. I guess it's on Hulu now because the FX run of the series has ended. I hope they give it some more episodes. This first season only had 8 episodes. Matthew Ehrlich and I both enjoyed it a lot, and I know you will as well. I am Neil Pollack. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. It's fall movie season. Go to the movies as often as you can. You will not regret it. And even if you do, there's always another movie to see. I will talk to you soon.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with